I'm actually proud to represent Mendip Spring when I go and play as a professional. When they stand on the tee and they say, on the tee, Scott Thompson representing Mendip Spring Golf Club, I know that I'm representing all those members, and they are the nicest members you can imagine. We've created a community at Mendip Spring. Everyone's welcome. I'm proud of that, and I know the owners are proud of that as well.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast with me, Chris Lynch. Here we are now, firmly in the festive season and in the run-up to Christmas. I have yet to eat my first mince pie, but I suspect that's probably imminent. And certainly where golf is concerned, don't know about you guys, but I've certainly managed to still get the odd golf fix here and there. Winter golf is certainly a bit of a different game. It can be tricky. It can be a bit of a slog sometimes, but it wasn't a slog at Mendip Spring, which was the host venue for both this podcast conversation you're about to listen to, as well as being the host venue for our latest Nine is Fine feature film. In case you've missed the previous few, just a reminder, that is to introduce or to spotlight nine-hole golf is a time-friendly, family-friendly, inclusive format of golf. Mendip Spring has a nine-hole full-length golf course called the Lakeside, which is where we filmed that episode over on YouTube. But it also has the 18-hole Brindsey Championship course. And part of the thinking behind doing this Nine is Fine series was to visit progressive golf facilities, which not only have nine-hole courses, but also ones that are looking at golf in a more modern, futuristic and inclusive light. And I'd say this is where today's guest, Scott Thompson, comes in. Scott, having risen through the ranks at Mendip Spring, he initially joined there as the head professional in 2014. He has since moved into a general manager role as of 2018. Going by this conversation, and as you will hear, as well as everything I personally saw and experienced firsthand when I visited Mendip Spring a few weeks ago, Scott, under his leadership, with the team that he has behind him, as well as with the support of the ownership there, the McCullough family, they are running a successful and prosperous business, which it wasn't so much that way 10 or so years ago. This was a place that was on the brink of bankruptcy. But since Scott has come in, and like I say, with continued investment from the McCulloughs, this is a place that has really turned around. We do cover a lot of ground in this conversation. We don't just solely focus on Mendip Spring as a club and Scott's role there. We also have a chat about his professional playing career. He played on the PGA Euro Pro Tour back in 2005. Certainly, from my perspective, I find that really insightful to listen to him talk about that experience, the things he learned about himself and as a golfer during that time. Within that segment, as well as throughout, you're going to hear a lot of things which I'm sure you can relate to as a golfer, as someone in business, as a member of a family, as a member of a community, and what your golf club might mean to you. So I'll round this out by again giving you a reminder. Head over to YouTube, use the link in the show notes, make sure you're subscribed there, because in a few days' time, we'll be releasing that Nine is Fine episode from the Lakeside course at Mendip Spring. And also, just a thanks once more to Scott for hosting us and to the kindness and the warmth that myself and my team experienced from the members there. So without any further ado, let's tee off and jump into this podcast conversation. Scott, welcome to the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. We recorded our fourth episode of the Nine is Fine feature film series. So anyone that's been listening to this who wasn't aware or hasn't already checked it out, please do. We had a great day on a great couple of hours spent on the Lakeside course, which was, that came first in this play. The nine-hole course was here before the 18-hole course, wasn't it?
Yeah, we started in the early 1991. Started with a nine-hole course. We had that built, and then we also had Fahrenheit, which was a ladies-only sort of gym. It wasn't a gym like you see with all the machines nowadays. It was a sauna, swimming pool, and then things like yoga, you know, Mr. Motivator style.
Yeah.
And then after that, shortly...
Mr. Motivator on our TVs these days, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
What a character he was. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. And then they started building the championship course, which came about 2 years later. So, and then about 6 months after that, the driving range came. So,
yeah.
It's been around, you know, quite a while now.
Nice. I think, you know, in this conversation, we're going to balance this, I think, in terms of talking about you as a professional golfer, but then you also as the general manager here and talking more about the club and what makes it so special. But I really loved listening to some of the things that you've said today. So again, please check out that Nine is Fine episode, because there's a really nice piece in it where you, Scott, are talking about, for example, here at Mendip Spring, like we've just said, you've got a 9-hole course, you've got an 18-hole course, but that importance to you of treating everyone as an equal and as a member.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. I think no matter what golfer you are, whether you come to this facility and you're just, there's a massive modern, over the last year, sort of 2 years, it's come around, it just goes on the driving range, you know, all these systems, computer systems that are on the driving range now have sort of added another golfer, and you've got to call them a golfer because they're coming there. The fact that they're not going on the physical course to play and they're just playing it through the computer system and the radar system, like we're just introducing TrackMan onto our driving range, everyone that uses it is a golfer. So I want to treat them the same. So when we first came here, it was a big thing, big change from the way it was done previous to our company, was that we wanted to integrate the Lakeside members as well as the Brindsey members into the club. So when you joined Mendip Spring, you joined and you were a member of Mendip Spring, of the club. You weren't a section, if you see what I mean. So if you play on the Lakeside course, your green fee is for free, you book, but you can also book to play on the Brindsey course, but you play that, your category of membership, you have a reduced fee, so it would be £15 rather than £55. You can still bring guests, you still get the discount behind the bar for food and drink, so you are a club member. On our committees, we always now make sure that the Lakeside are represented, so we have a gentleman called Stuart Marshall. He sits on our competitions committee and he can voice any sort of competition ideas and we take them forward. But also he can come into this office, into my office, the door's always open to all members, but he can come in and he can speak to me about things that he thinks that need to happen with the Lakeside course as well. Mm-hmm. So as well, obviously the same happens with the Brindsey, but I just think that it's really important that everyone is it's a community.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean?
A few of the other things you said to me today, like, so for example, is it your 7-year-old, did you say?
Yeah,
he's like an absolute master. He's a shark when it comes to mini golf. Or
oh yeah, he thinks that mini golf is his favorite. If you say, where's your favorite place in the world, he would be on the mini golf.
Yeah,
playing mini golf. I mean, I call it crazy golf, but I'm old, so but basically mini golf, adventure golf, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, where I wanted to go with this and get your view on this is you know, you obviously you're an advanced fellow of the PGA,
advanced fellow,
you're a general manager, you will almost definitely get regular industry updates and white papers, or like, I often read it used to be a print magazine, the PGA Golf Business Quarterly magazine,
yeah,
but it's a digital thing now.
Yeah.
And there's a really, really interesting research piece in there a few issues back, which basically touched on this idea of, you know, essentially, you've got so many different formats of golf these days, right? Whether it's mini golf, it's driving ranges, it's pitch and putt, you know, it's full 18-hole, 9-hole courses, whatever. And it was almost to exactly to your point of saying, we ought to be treating and referring to all of these people as golfers.
Yeah.
Although they might not, the research was interesting to say they don't see themselves as a golfer per se, but I almost wanted to get your take. So part of why I started Golf Yourself Healthy was very much grounded in the belief that golf is good for your health and well-being. And if I'm being honest, when I talk about that, I really had meant it in the context of being out in nature, being out on a golf course. But do we need to be, I'll ask you this from a personal point of view, but also you're obviously going to have your GM hat on as well and commercially or whatever, but do we need to be bothered, for want of a better word, around moving people through from, like, do we really need to graduate someone from mini golf to big course golf, or can we just let everyone exist in that ecosystem and do things their own way, if you get what I mean?
I personally think you can let them do it in their own way.
Yeah.
You know, I do think there's certain groups. I think with juniors, You want to be moving them into a progress, into a program, only because it can help them with life skills and progress them through. And golf will be something they can do for the rest of their lives. Yeah. So you can take a 5-year-old and he could learn to play golf up until he was 12, give it up. But then he gets a job later on in life where golf, he might have a corporate membership or something like that, or he gets invited to a golf day to do a business deal. They can just take golf back up again. So it's something for life. But then when it comes to people that just want to play mini golf or people that just want to go to the driving range with their friends and hit some balls, I don't think you need to group them or force them to become a member. What we look at here at Men at Spring is more just getting them to use the facility. I think that's the most important thing. So we've opened up our lakes on our lakeside course for fishing. I haven't done that to get more golf members and things like that. It's really, what I want is people coming and using the facility. So they come up, they fish, they bring their families, they might come in for Sunday lunch. And all that creates a nice vibe around the clubhouse. So that when my golfers go in there, it's not silence and that awkward situation. And I think it's all about being, you've got to have your families and that, but also you want people to come like groups of girls, groups of boys, boyfriend, girlfriend, sort of, getting involved in the in just doing a physical activity, a sport, and then socializing afterwards. I mean, I'm a professional golfer, but not everyone, other people aren't. So it's a hobby, but it can also help you relax, take you away from the, you know, the busy life that people have. And it's something like you said, you could have it to enjoy the scenery. You know, if you're liking nature, you can go out and you can see, go out and play early on the golf course here, you can see the deers, you can see the swans, you can see all this, but then you could see a nice sunset. I think golf, you could sort of, it can have, stimulates other parts of your system.
Well, I mean, system. I think producer Lewis, who sat to our right here, I saw it with my own eyes. He got bored of filming me playing golf and went and filmed the squirrel for a while, like bounding around out in the lakeside. So it became like, you know, a golf. This became a nature program instead of, you know, but to your point.
So when you're trying to putt out on the lakeside and you get the family of ducks coming across the green.
Hang on. Keep it down, please. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know, I'm a professional at this game.
Yeah, big time. You know what? Let's stay on Mend at Spring for the moment before we move on. I've built Golf Yourself Healthy around this belief that, you know, golf mimics life. You know, golf can feel quite unfair and give you bad breaks. Yeah. And it's this theme of adversity and resilience. So those themes are definitely things that have affected this golf club, right, in terms of adversity. Because about 10 or 11 years ago, from what you're telling me, it was in a bad place, but it's really turned around. And how do you reflect on that?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't involved in the club at that time. I was sort of an outsider. I've learned more about it now because we looked into it. But basically, the golf club, the previous owner ran the business at a loss for many years, a hefty loss. And then when he passed away, his daughter needed to, she tried to sort of turn it around in the first year, but she realised that she couldn't. So she needed to get to move it on, and then a rumor sort of started coming round that she'd sold it and was going to be a lorry park, and it was just going to be returned into that. So the members called an extraordinary meeting. They asked her to come along to it, and they put a proposal to her and said, if we can find someone to keep it a golf course, would you be happy to do that? And obviously it was her dad's part of one of his passions, so she said, yes, I'll give you a week. So luckily the old professional John Blackburn got straight on the phone to Chris McCullough, a local businessman who lived just down the road, and he just said, Chris, I know you've been interested in buying the golf course for the last 20 years. There's an opportunity for you to buy it. And I might be slightly wrong with this, but I believe Chris was away, not in the country, and he sent his daughter down, Heidi, to have a look around and meet the sellers and everything, and then Chris came back and a deal was done. And then the club was saved. They took over in June 2014. I happened to come along and play on a charity golf day here because I knew some of the members, and we happened to have a good score, so we had to wait around for the prize giving, and we decided that we were going to stay here and have some food. And when I was doing that, I was introduced to Chris as the owner, and we sat talking, and I met Heidi. and they asked me some questions and they asked me about what I'd done in the game and everything. So I spoke to them about that. And then 2 weeks later, I had a private message, a DM on Facebook from Heidi asking me to come and have a meeting. And from there, we've grown this golf club into not just a stable business, but a place where people can come and enjoy the game, start the game. We've been involved in schools. We've been involved in local communities and doing work at fates. We were heavily involved in the golf partnership. So we were going around with the county with an inflatable golf net, doing things like that. I mean, I've been up on up in Bristol opposite the Hippodrome, where the waterfall is, sort of doing golf lessons, promoting Mendip Spring. We honestly, there's so much stuff that we've been involved in. We've just had a year. We've just raised £37,000 for the Western Hospice with our captain that's just left, Jackie Richards. She's just left office on Saturday, so the cheque was presented, and you know, it's I believe we've done a lot of good in the you know, since 2014.
Yeah, in the community. I'm going to go a bit deeper on that for a second, because like, it's difficult to run a golf club. It's expensive to run a golf club.
Yep.
And ultimately, you look around the UK, in Scotland where I'm from, I'm seeing like there's a big campaign recently about how, is it Caird Park? I can't remember. It's like a lot of the public council-owned golf courses, a lot of these are closing down now because they were running at a loss as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important that it would have been an enormous loss back then if this place, because what I'm saying is the importance of golf clubs in the community is massive. And if I just reflect on what I've seen and heard here today, right? So for example, you know, we've come in off the lakeside, we've gone in for a bit of lunch, and we've got chatting to one of your pros, George, and Lindsay, your oldest member, right?
Yeah.
At 95, did you
say?
Yeah,
95,
Lindsay
Delacaster. You know,
and just a wonderful conversation with him, right? He was telling me he had his second ever hole in one recently, and he got it with a driver as well, said. And he was like, oh, you know, I can only really hit a driver these days. I was like, mate, I've never had a hole in one. And actually getting one with a driver as well is like, that's a great achievement in and of itself. But also, when you got set up in that buggy outside, ready to go out to the lakeside, I overheard these two guys, you know, just chatting in the car park, being like, oh, such and such, how's your wife doing at the moment? We said, she's not doing so good at the moment, you know. And it's stuff like that where you can, that's where you realise that's what golf is. Golf gives people a platform to like chat about these things, to connect, especially as guys as well, to talk about stuff they wouldn't normally talk about, right?
Yeah, you know, my partner said to me recently, I went out with my friends and they said, oh, did you talk about this? You know, how? And I said, not really, just talked about golf and football and that, you know, lads do, you know, took the mick out of each other.
You've just been on a 3-day golf weekend with your mates. Like, how's the family? Like, how are the kids? Don't know.
No, but then you can do that. You know, you can take yourself away from the everyday problems.
Yes.
I always think golf can do all sorts. Like when you're a kid, it teaches you some etiquette, because there are standards at golf. It's not you know, it's not snobby like everyone thinks, but you know, just the courtesy when you're playing, and you're quiet and stand still when someone hits a shot. Mm. But then it teaches you to add up and, you know, these sort of things, as well as, like you said, you learning to deal with pressure, because you've got to learn to play. If you've played a bad shot, you can't just smash the green or smash the ground, you know. It's not the done thing.
Well, you can, you'll get banned, but
you get brought up. So yeah, again, that's another thing, like a member might look at it and they don't just come over and there's not an argument, there's just I don't think you should be doing that, and then the other person responds in a nice way, oh thank you for helping me, or you know, the classic, the golfer that thinks he can help the other golfer, or keep your head down, or you know, that sort of thing. You see, hear that down the driving range. But then you can also create, because you're creating relationships, you might meet someone, like, you know, you might have been struggling at work and lost your job.
Yeah.
So you come up the golf club and you're a bit down in the dumps, and then, you know, you're playing in a roll up and you start chatting to a guy and he's like, I need a lorry driver. Do you know what I mean? So it opens up a door for things like that. So it's like you said, really, golf starts a conversation.
Mm.
And whether that conversation is about life, about a sport, you know, you're going round and you're out there for 4 hours, and you can cover loads of topics, or you could cover nothing. You could just talk about what you're seeing.
Anything and everything.
And it's whatever just relaxes you and helps you to enjoy it. And I think that's really important. Compared to other sports that are more hustle and bustle, you come to golf, you can have your competitive edge because you can testing yourself against your own score.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have a competitive against someone else if you want to do. Or you can just go out and you can, you know, just go out and enjoy it. That's something I found in my game where I've changed over the last few years, is when I was playing golf to start with, I sort of enjoyed it as a kid, but then I thought, oh, I want a job. I want this to be my career. So therefore, it got very serious. So every round I was playing, it was to a certain level. And then I would then think, oh, I need to get better. So I need to be set myself a target, 4 under for 9 holes. So yeah. Then you're pushing yourself all the time. And I'd lost like the enjoyment of going out and just having a knock with my friends. So then when I came into the job here, I made sure that all the pros, I wanted them all to play. And I started playing in some local events and that. But then we started playing with the members. So my first captain when I first came here was Andy Burton. So I went out and played. We did beat the pro. And we just basically asked people to put £20 into the captain's charity. And we went out and played and just had a knock. There was a little bit of a game on it. You know, there was a bit. Some people wanted banter. Some people just wanted to go around and play with the captain. And at the time, I was the head professional. And we catered for that. But I think that's what golf is about. It's just, like you said, just it's whatever you feel at the time.
Mm.
And it can help you in any shape or form of life, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. I want to, so let's maybe segue for a minute here, mm-hmm. just into your professional golfing, because you played in the EuroPro Tour for a while, right?
Yeah, I had my EuroPro Tour card for a year. And I played, I mean, that was quite stressful doing that. So that was a different kettle of fish. So I was at the Players Club at the time and I was a teaching pro and I was very lucky. I met Gordon Brand Jr., who at the time was 10th on the all-time money winners list. I was with Paul Barrington, who was World Trick Shot Champion. So I had a lot of good golfers around me and they sort of pushed me to be driven a little bit more. So I started taking it seriously and I ended up playing just generally.
Did you want that though? Was that because they saw potential in you, do you think?
Yeah, they saw potential and they gave me the confidence to have a go at it. So,
right, okay.
But then I started playing on Wednesday in this role. So I got invited to this role. So there was some very good professionals, Simon Hurley, Dave Ray, all played on tour. And they used to play for some money. I mean, it was 25, 25, 25. So if two tied, everyone tied, there was no money out there. But for me, I looked at it and thought, oh, I could win a few hundred pounds here. So
right. They
got me playing that. So my golf game evolved. You know, I had to think of it, oh, the front line, I have to be 2 or 3 under par because that will tie or win. To me, for them, it wasn't massive money. But as an assistant at the time, it was a lot of money to me. But then my game got so sharp. And then the members came to me and said that they put £200 in each. So some of the other pros at the golf club have put £200 in out of their own money. And they gave me a pot of money to go and play on the EuroPro Tour. So I, after Christmas, because qualifying then was in April, so I went and hit balls on the range. And at the time it was snowing and I was up there and Brandy said to me, it's a job now, Scott, this is your job. So 8 o'clock in the morning, I used to arrive at the golf club, have a coffee, hit balls till 11:30. Then I'd go and have a coffee break. Then I'd hit balls again until about 1. And then after lunch, I would then either go and play some holes or it might be we were testing a new driver. And we'd do that sort of thing. And then it became a bit of a motion. And then Jeff Twentyman was at the golf club as a member and he was doing BBC Bristol Radio. So then he decided, oh, we're going to follow Scott on his path through. So I'd go and practice and he'd come up on the range and interview me and then after a round I'd speak to him. And basically these people gave me the opportunity to try and make it as a top pro. So well, Paul Barrington had said to me there's 30 or 40 coaches in Bristol and he said, what's gonna make you different to everyone else? So I thought, oh, what I'll do. So I went on some courses and I did some residentials up at the Belfry and I learned about putting and I became this putting coach and everyone, you know, kindly called me the putting professor. So I was in this bit of playing and then I had this scope and Brandy was struggling with his putting. So he said, oh, could you come and give me some lessons and coach me?
Yeah.
So I started coaching Brandy and then it sort of evolved more. We created this nice banter, this nice relationship. And then Mark Sanders, he was on the tour at the time from Knoll Golf Club. And he was like, oh, you're teaching Brandy. Can I come and have some putting lessons? And then George was my coach as a junior. And then I became his putting coach. And
how
he
cool
was playing.
Was
so I then had this option, and I was missing cuts, and I just thought, I'm just don't quite have it, I don't, I'm not quite good enough, basically.
Yeah.
But I had this thing with teaching, so then I dropped, I sort of slowed my playing down, and I sort of thought about my coaching more, and that became a big thing. And Brandy came and he asked me to be a, become a swing coach and short game coach, and I did that for 2 years with Brandy. I went all over the UK with him.
What I'm taking away from some of the, there's a couple of things, right? So one, if I'm hearing you right, it sounded like at a point where you've had this crack at the pro tour, let's say, it just hasn't worked in the way you might have wanted it to, but in the process, you've actually discovered a separate strength and a passion that's given you an opportunity to kind of like, all's not lost here. Do you know, I've got this putting kind of specialism. Do you get? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it completely changed. I didn't go out and set out when I turned professional to be a putting coach.
No, it just so happened.
It just sort of happened.
By accident, almost.
I wasn't very good at putting. It was a weakness in my game. So then I read all the books. I read the Bob Ritellas.
And what turned it into a strength then?
Yeah, because I learned a lot about it. So then I then became... I've actually became friends with a guy called Nick Middleton. And he owns Zen Oracle. Now, the Zen putter didn't... It is a big thing. Retief Goosen used it when he won his two majors. But it was mainly, you'll see it on tour, and it's about the putting green, the lab that moves.
Yeah.
That's his thing, biggest thing that people know him for. But he started talking to me, and he wasn't a golfer. And he used to come to Mendip Spring, and he'd be showing me his putter, and he'd say, oh, I dream about this putter, you know? And I think, oh, he's a bit weird. but he was such a nice guy, and he started talking to me about things like the line on the putter, the colour of the line. If someone's colourblind, they need to have a line that they can see. So he was going right the way down to that, what we talked about earlier, the 1% of making something better. And that made me think about the putting. So then I started thinking outside the box, like drawing the line on the ball. Why just one line? What colour pen should you use on the line? So then when I was talking to Brandy, and Andrew Coulthard was really good friends with Brandy, and he used to come down to the players, come and play. And it was really nice. Afterwards, Stuart Little, nicknamed Mouse, he used to come and we'd play. And then we'd go in the class and sit and just talk about little things. It was like dieting and things like that. And like I talk about the colour, and I go, oh, I never thought about changing the colour on the line I draw on the ball, because I hadn't come across it. So that sort of then put me at, like, they thought of me at a different level, if you see what I mean.
Tell me more about that, the colour of the line in the ball.
So what we're talking about is, like, for instance, if you're using a red line, you might have someone that's colourblind and can't pick up the colour on the green.
Right, yeah.
It might be that red, a certain person might need to use navy. It was all black. It was a unique thing. So how we did it is I got players to line stuff up, and I used it at the time. They'd only just come out. They use quite a bit now, but like a laser. So I had a basically a bit of double glazing board, and I put lines on it, and I asked them from say 15 feet to aim the putter at 3 inches right of the hole. So I put this behind, and they would do it. Now what I did find is with Brandy, he would be, when I mean spot on, he would be on it. So he wouldn't put a ball down with no line on it. He would just, by eye, look up and line, and he was on that line every time. It was incredible. But that's why I think he was such a good golfer, because that was like his thing. He was in the perfect slot. Whereas other people I saw struggle. I was always slightly to the right. So I then started putting the line on the ball and lining it up. You know, Tiger Woods brought this along. But no one had sort of thought about the colour of it. It's just something really small and little, you know. I know years ago Luke Donald was talking about he went through a bad spell, and it was his shoes, because he changed the style of shoe he was using, so the heel was quarter of an inch higher up, which meant then he was slightly different over the ball, so he wasn't striking it as well. Now there's a difference between striking it and striking it almost, because I learned this very early with Brandy. I'd say good shot, and he'd say no, it wasn't. And his margin of error was so different to anyone else I'd ever taught. I used to actually not say anything and wait for him to give me the feedback. I could see the flight and saw his swing, but I just stopped saying, because I knew it was irritating him.
Yeah.
Because his margin of error was so different to anyone else I'd ever seen, and his perfect shot, what I thought was a perfect shot, even at my standard, wasn't perfect for him. So he didn't want you to say it was perfect.
I have heard
if
that.
You sort of mean.
No, I do, and I think what was something you just said there made me think. So there's another. So that was it. So actually, just yesterday, in fact, we were interviewing another episode that I can't remember will come out either before or after this one, with Neil Matthews, who's my coach. He's like Wales head of that national team coach, right? Just a good guy. And I was talking to him about how, depending on who you talk to or you listen to in golf, there's a lot of ego in golf. And some people will say, like, who are you to give advice to a golfer? You're a ex-handicapper or whatever kind of thing. But he said, Rotella is an 18 handicapper, not great at golf. Look at how he's transformed McIlroy and helped McIlroy win. Do you know what I mean? And then also, the thing that you were saying about your example of helping Brandy, was it Brandy with the putting?
Yeah.
Goes to show that, like, so there was a, I always think a couple of, so I think a trait of a resilient person is to be humble enough to know where they can learn from somebody else. Like, they might know that they're great in certain aspects, but like, if you can go and learn from somebody else. A great example of this was a few years ago at the Masters, John Rahm. You know all that footage you get in the run-up to, on like Sky or whatever, the range or like on the short game area.
That's the best stuff.
It is the best stuff. It is, right? But then you can never find it again because it's like, it's not recorded or like you can't go on YouTube and find it necessarily. And there was this clip of Ola Sabol giving Rahm bunker lessons. And I'm thinking, Rahm is like, Ola Sabol was obviously a legend of his time, but Rahm would drive a ball past him for miles away. But the point is, Rahm is humble enough to go, I can learn something from you. Do you get what I mean? And that dynamic between
that
you.
That is one of the things. I read Tiger Woods' autobiography, the one around Augusta and how he won at Augusta and the Masters. And he talks in there about when he was 15 and 16, going to Augusta, and he used to pick players to play with in the practice rounds. And some of them, he just went up and he didn't even play with them. He just met them on the chipping green or the putting green. And he talks about Seve, Alazabal, Fred Couples.
Mm.
And he talks about, like, they taught him how to draw chips and fade a chip and to hit different shots. And that was, it's incredible really, because he, someone like that, and Jack Nicklaus, he used to talk about taking the heel of the wedge off and grinding it. And he actually, back in the day, used to grind other players' wedges in the tour vans to help them. And you got to think, they were all competitive. You know, you imagine Tom Watson, you know.
Yeah.
He was head to head with Jack Nicklaus, and they're in a tour van together, helping each other grind the heel off a wedge. Or, you know, you see stuff now, you see like Gary Player rocking up with Lee Trevino and Jack Nicklaus a couple of years ago, and they're talking about their swings, and they're still trying to tweak it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jack Nicklaus won 18 majors, but he's having a lesson from Gary Player, and Gary Player's, oh, yesterday I thought about just moving my elbow an inch in. You know, he's one of the greatest golfers that ever played, and he's still talking to his peers about the game, and I do think that's so important. The bit when I sit with George and just listen to his stories. He's coached Johnny Morgan, that you see commentating.
Yeah.
You know, he's an absolute legend. But I mean, he tells the stories about his time in America with John, and the stories are just incredible. And I always think that's important. That's another thing of golf. When I was at the Players, I was young, and I had a group of rangers that looked after the course, and Paul said to me, you need to learn about their background and find out what they are. You're young, they're sort of retired, you know, you need to get some kind of respect. And they said the best way to do that would be to sit and just chat with them and see what they've done. And I was speaking this guy called Ed Ferguson, and I found out that he had been the CEO of two companies at the same time. And one was in North America and one was in Asia. And basically it was the conveyor belts in airports. And he was going across two continents in a week. And then he starts telling me, I like yachting. He said, I've got to tell you about the time I was boarded by pirates. And I'm like, God, this guy, like, I've never even thought about this thing. And it's just like, it's just incredible when you speak to people. But that's what I'm saying about golf. That's why golf is so different, because you can have that. You can meet them before the round, after the round. It's just, yeah, you like you said, you could sit and chat to them. I could sit and talk to them for hours about some of the things, because it's just incredible, really.
Yeah, definitely. I've got to ask you this, right? Because you're, you know, you've obviously got your finger in a lot of different parts. You've got a busy job here. You've got a lot going on, but you still manage to find the time for that, for a family life, for playing professional golf as well. How do you... I'm always curious, because I'm obviously with me and what I stand for in this brand is about health and well-being. So how do you look after yourself? How do you put yourself first? When and another thing, right? You know, you clearly make time for everybody. Like, that office door is almost always open, and that, you know, it takes its toll as well. Like, doing good for others is...
I think it does good, but then I like it, because I think when I used to teach, I would... You know, I did take it too far. At one point, I had alopecia. I had a massive patch of hair care because I was just couldn't say no.
Not through because, stress
yeah,
induced.
Through stress. But I didn't feel stressed because I loved coaching and I just wanted to go out and help someone improve their game.
Sure.
There was nothing better for me. But at the time, I was starting at 7:30 in the morning, teaching every hour all the way through to about 9:30 at night. I'd get home and then I'd want to send every lesson a video, so I do a voiceover on their swing, analyze it, and send it to their phones. And I wanted to do that, but so I'd be finished about 10:30 at night. But the next day was the same thing again, and it wasn't a money thing; it was just purely because I just took the pleasure out of helping the golfers improve and seeing them improve. And that is really what I've got. I've got a massive passion for Mendip Spring, and anyone that talks to me, you know, some of my peers get, "Oh God, he's going on about Mendip Spring again." But it's not that. I will put it forward because I think it's an amazing place. Not only have the owners given me an opportunity to sort of excel and show what I can do, it's I've got relationships with the members, and I'm actually proud to represent Mendip Spring when I go and play as a professional. Mm. When they stand on the tee and they say, on the tee, Scott Thompson representing Mendip Spring Golf Club, I know that I'm representing all those members, and they are the nicest members you can imagine. We've created a community at Mendip Spring where everyone's welcome, but everyone talks, you know, we have an open tea time system where people can book and join someone. People don't just drop out and think, oh, I don't want to play with that guy or that lady. They'll play, they'll join in. And I know you did it when you came today. Members in the clubhouse were talking to you and just coming up and showing you where to go and helping you generally. And that, I'm proud of that.
Mm.
And I know the owners are proud of that as well. You know, for instance, during COVID, that was a hard, hard time. We didn't know when we shut down just overnight, we didn't know whether we were going to survive. So it was really stressful. And the next morning I came in, because obviously we needed to check to make sure security was on site and stuff. And Chris was here and I was talking to him, and I took a phone call actually from a member that had a broken leg, and he reinstated his membership to make sure the golf club would survive. So he couldn't play. We were shut down for COVID. He had a broken leg, yet he signed up and paid £90
in order to help kind of
reinstate his direct debit to make sure the golf club survived.
Wow.
And in that time,
that's amazing.
And Chris was really, really taken aback by that. It was like, you know, it is something that we do. And
so I tell you,
really important.
Why that is such an incredible story, right? So one of the best books that's had an impact on me in recent times has been Start With Why by Simon Sinek. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of Simon Sinek. So like really great TED talk he does. And he's like a leadership guru and American. Well, no, in fact, he's English, but he's been based in the US for a long time. His book, Start With Why, basically the central theme to it is saying loads of very successful businesses are very good at telling you what they do, how great their product is, what they sell, you know, and how they make it and all the rest of it and all the features and benefits. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them don't sort of explain why they do what they do. The why will say a lot about the passion and the purpose that sits behind the bit. And you have just spoken a lot about passion and purpose, but there's one specific story that he tells in his book where after 9/11, which was a terrible time for the airline industry in the US, particular, Southwest Airlines much like you just described with that member, they had customers, loyal customers, just donating money, basically saying, you know, thanks for what you've done for us over the years, kind of thing. And I think, again, that just goes back to that's what golf clubs do and mean in communities, basically.
Oh, massively, yeah. And during those times, we were the same. We reversed it as well. So we had members over that 3-year period where they perhaps might not have been able to claim furlough or situations like that. So we would help them. So mm-hmm. we'd still let them play golf and when they were allowed to, but we didn't charge them their membership fee because we knew that they were in struggling times themselves. So
yeah.
We had a group of members that we would, you know, if people contacted me, we would try and help them as much as we could. Because
and
I do think that's a big thing about golf that's different to other sports. I mean, I love football and all this sort of thing, but this is quite a money-driven sort of business now, and it's not so much about being in a community. Whereas I think golf, especially golf, whether it's a members golf club or a proprietary club like we are, it's still, I think the members still know that we're investing. Like we're just about to put TrackMan on our driving range, and that is a big investment.
Yes.
And
yep.
Chris hasn't said, oh, well, we're going to levy the members and add it onto their bill or anything like that. He's just said, yeah, I will do it. Yes, obviously as a club we will benefit from it, but also the members benefit from it. It's you know, it's an all circle, and again, it's another community thing. So from our point of view, from the company's point of view, what we want to do is to have people using the facility. Like I said about the fishing, it's not, oh yeah, we're going to make money out of fishing. It's like, we've opened up the fishing. It's nice that people can come and fish. So we see families there. It's the golfers mingle in nicely. They come in around the facility. Do you know what I mean? It's not, I mean, at the minute, I'm trying to set up a walking group. I'm just thinking people could meet here. We've got footpaths around the golf club and outside of it. So I think, oh, so they meet at the club. Members can come, outside member, you know, non-members can come. They can join a proper walking group. They can walk safely. They can see the nature that we've got around the course. They can walk around the area. Then they can come back and they can have like a coffee and a cake and a chat in the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing that we want to create, because that is us in the community helping it. And it's like, you know, a local business, or well, not so much a business, sorry, a charity, or someone's in the area is doing a sponsored walk, and they want to do a raffle, and they ask for a voucher. You know, it's never a no. It's always, yeah, how can I help you? And I always want to say, you know, help them. And yes, it raises awareness, like, you know, when they read it out in front of 100 odd people, oh, Mendip Spring donated this prize.
Yeah.
So, you know, we get a little bit out of it, but really it isn't. It's just helping the community and letting people in the community know that Mendip Spring is open to the public, because that is just a huge thing. Like, we put stuff on Facebook and they message,
which a lot of golf clubs get wrong, and I think, like, very easily. Yeah
they do. They become stuffy. Oh no, I don't want to do that. Or they restrict how many they give out, and I don't agree with that, because I genuinely think, yes, I'm giving a green free away, but they might come and have a drink, or they might come back and they go, oh, that course is, I haven't played Mendip Spring before.
Yeah,
what an amazing visit. Like, you haven't played this course before, you've gone out and played, and you know, I'm hoping that you think, oh, that's nice, I'll come back.
100%, yeah.
Because you know,
I've got my 40th business next year, and thinking about where I can bring some of my mates for a little sort of cover. So I'm eyeing up your because what you were saying there is, this is more than a golf club, right? It's very smart,
it is,
like bringing the fishing people in, or like the walk. It's again, stuff like that. I think word of mouth in communities is still a thing as well. So all it takes is for someone to go, like, oh, do you know what? Like, I was up at, I'm not a golfer, but I was up at Mendip Spring. I did a bit of fishing in the lake or whatever. And then I went in and had a bit of lunch, and it snowballs from there. And then people,
it does. Yeah. It's massive. And I see that a lot in the emails, because people will message me and they will say, oh, just, I had a friend who stayed in your hotel. He was going to Spain, and he said how nice the facilities were when he came in the clubhouse. You know, I'm thinking about my golf group where, you know, can you give me some prices, please? And that's just come from a person.
Yeah, exactly.
Word of mouth.
Well, on the accommodation, so you've got a hotel bit, like literally outside your office here. These are like more hotel rooms, and you've kind of got dormy accommodation.
Yeah, so we've got 20 rooms, so we can sleep around 39, say, golfers. Because I say golfers because some rooms have got double beds, and, you know, if you've got same sex people coming and playing groups, you're not going to be able to double them up. So it's probably about 40.
Depends how good friends you really are. That's a real test of your friendship. Yeah.
So we have that. So that brought a different marketing, and that's something that we worked on that was when I came in as the manager. They just we got more into that. We were selling, marketing the rooms to, you know, online and booking.com, these places. But then I thought about it and doing a package and getting golfers to come and stay over. So we designed a package and then we marketed it. So I used a company local to us called Golf Southwest. Jeremy Larkham, he's a local lad, plays for Somerset. And he had this business where he was promoting golf tours to Cornwall. And then he was like, oh, wow, they might want to stop on the way. So we got more into his own county, which was Somerset. So I teamed up with him and I created a package with him and our owner, Heidi, the daughter, Chris's daughter. Mm-hmm. She's very hands-on and likes to get involved. So we talked about it and we created a package for people to come and play. And that was massive for our business. That really sort of changed where we were within the marketing. Because when we first came in, the golf course was the golf course was... The layout of the golf course was exceptional. Terry Murray was the course designer, and he's designed multiple courses around this area, and it was really, really good. But the way it was looked after wasn't. So, for instance, they used gang mowers on the fairways. So if people that don't know what that is, it's just a mower dragged along the back of a tractor that would bounce along, miss cuts. So Heidi and Chris were like, well, we really need to sort of move. We wanted to move to the next level. So we sort of looked at other golf courses, not so much in our area, but just a little bit outside of that, of where we would like to be. So we invested in proper mowers, hydraulic mowers, and we cut stripes on the fairway. Heidi's not a golfer, so she wanted to know what I was talking about. So she asked me to do like a course report. I've still got it on the computer, actually. Like what sort of equipment we needed, what we needed to do course-wise, how were we going to get the business in a position where we weren't making these huge losses. I said to her, you can, you know, two halves or stripes. And she said, oh, what stripes? So she quite liked that. So then we brought the stripes in. And we got the golf course pretty quickly into a better condition visually. So you could see it. And that then helped us get more members. And then we could market it to like the stay and play groups. And that then meant that I didn't have to fill the golf course and close it to the members. I could just have 30 guys coming along. That's half an hour of tea times, doesn't affect the membership. I mean, you do get the odd ones that are a bit slow and stuff like that, which we've got to monitor, but you know, that's golf, you know,
of course,
modern golf at the minute.
Yes,
but that then meant that because they were staying here, then I fed them in the evening. They then used the facilities in the clubhouse, so it meant things like, oh, I want to have Sky. So we don't make any money from Sky as a golf club. It's not people put Sky in and they think, oh, we're going to have everyone watching the football. It's not about that. It's like it's when the cricket's on and there's a couple of overs and people just stay in that clubhouse that little bit longer. Or like, you know, people can't believe what's the Grand Prix in the clubhouse. Or it might be a big football match and you get a couple of people, or it might be the rugby. But it's not really. It's like Chris thinks it's definitely like a feature and benefit. It's not like a lost leader, isn't it? It's like, it's not going to make you money, but it keeps people here. But that means with the groups, we can have them here. We've got a pool table. We've got darts.
Totally.
We've got Skittles. It's all things that these
people... You're catering for diverse needs there. Yeah. And you're just making sure... It's not taking a box, if you know what I mean, but it's like it's making sure that you've got the... And I love the way you're thinking about that. It's like, if we have that, then actually that may help us lead to... We sell a few more pints, or we sell a bit more F&B.
We look at it in the winter, the clubhouse. A lot of golf clubs, they just go like, oh, shut, shut, shut. And I like to look at it a different way. And I know the, like, I've learned from Chris and Heidi and that. And I think if you shut something down, it's very hard to get it back again. So I've had shops, and I went to another golf club in the area and had a shop, and they sort of, the person that was there before me had almost driven everyone to buy online. So then what happens, very hard to change people's habits. So what I'm saying here is if you shut your kitchen early, people just think, oh, the kitchen's closed. It's very hard to then restart it. So what we've looked at here is a way of keeping it open through other means. So we get involved in the Rotary Club, so they come every Monday. So that means they have food at 7. So my kitchen is open. So if a member happens to go up to the driving range, he will... He can go in the clubhouse. Do you know what I mean? So it's like a knock-on effect. So yeah, we probably couldn't afford to keep the clubhouse open and make a loss just because one guy might want a pizza after going on the driving range. But if I've got 20 guys eating in a private room out the back, having a talk and a speech every Monday. That means the person that goes to the driving range every Monday sees that the clubhouse is open. So then he will pop in for a coffee. He will pop in for that. So it's like a little Brucey bonus sort of thing on the on the takings. But that then makes the golf club again more sustainable. So you know, you're going out with your family. You think, oh yeah, let's go to Mendip Spring. They'll be open. I'll pop in on the way through. So just these other little things have helped us. It's like I was talking to you earlier about the conferencing and the clubhouse. It's like, for me, it just gets people using a room. It doesn't affect my members out on the golf course. They might have to park a bit further away, but you know, if I have a conference in there, 30, 40 people, 20 people, even 10, it's easy. You serve them a coffee in the morning, a bacon roll, then they have lunch, and I've equipped the room to so that they're not constantly coming back and asking staff for things. They're sort of in their own little room, in their own little thing, and it's helping the company and the golf club provide a better facility for the members and for the local community. And I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
So
big time, absolutely. Yeah. If any of my viewers or listeners weren't already ready to sort of get off the fence and come here. I mean, you said something to me earlier. You were like, I know I'm biased, but I'd say, bar maybe Burnham and Barrow, this is the top place in Somerset or in the southwest. So, what would you say to people, like, why should they come here if they're a visitor?
Why should they come here? I would say that we can cater, and we will provide a facility for any type of group. So, you know, you can have your serious golfers that come and they want to really play a competition. So I can help them organize it. I don't know, like a big charity day. We had one recently for Hinkley Point. Their person, a person had passed away, a worker there, and they needed somewhere, and he'd actually played our 9-hole course. So they said, oh, it'd be nice to come. So the gentleman that was organizing it never organized a golf day, so we literally took his whole golf day, helped him over the last 4 or 5 months, completely organized it, ran it all on the day. So it was nice and easy, so we could cater for that. Or I get the people that say, oh, I'd like a surprise for my granddad. It's his 70th birthday. We'd like to take him away for a weekend with my boys. What can you do for me? And I can do a small package and we can look after them like that. Or if you just want to come up and think, oh, I want to give golf a go, you can come up and you can go on the driving range, you dab your card, balls drop out, you hit it. If you haven't got any clubs, you can come up to the clubhouse and Will, the head professional, in his shop, he'll sort you out some clubs. If you want to take it a bit more serious and think I want a lesson, you can do that. Or if it's a rainy day and your golf course is closed or you don't fancy going out in the rain, you can come down and use a studio and you'll be able to use the bays. It's a bit of everything.
I tell you, you've got everything covered in here. When you had me in the pro shop earlier, you still do spike replacing for people and stuff as well.
Yeah,
like, that's a service you don't necessarily see everywhere, you know. So, you know, you asked me earlier, have I enjoyed my day here? Absolutely have. Hope to come back, plan to come back.
Excellent.
And thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Scott.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.